Before we jump into today's episode, I'd like to quickly invite you to a free resource that brings together CEOs and senior business leaders to discuss strategic planning, execution, and business performance. I'm hosting a free live webinar where we dive deeper into the practical side of strategy development, execution, and leadership. They're not presentations as much as conversations with plenty of opportunity to ask questions and share experiences with other CEOs and senior leadership teams just like you. If you'd like an invitation to the next session, simply click the first link in the description below and my team will send you an invite. Now, on with the podcast. I'm John Downes, and the Critical Few Actions to Improve Your Business podcast is the show for founders, CEOs, and business owners who want to cut through the noise, focus on what matters most, and build a better performing business by identifying and acting on the critical few actions that will really move the needle. Today, I'm speaking with Richard Seymour, CEO and founder of Mount Zero Olives, one of Australia's best known olive and olive oil brands. This is not just a story about olives and olive oil or Australian produce. It's a story about a question many founders eventually face. Is this still just a good product, or are we building a stronger business around it? Mount Zero began with a farm and a strong sense of place. But over time, Richard and the team had to build something much broader, a food brand, a manufacturing and distribution capability, trusted relationships with chefs, retailers, and growers, and the commercial discipline to protect margin, cash flow, and quality. In this conversation, we talk about moving beyond the farm gate, using values as decision filters, the brand value that became visible during COVID, and what had to change when Richard realized he was becoming the bottleneck. It's a practical case study for any founder who knows the product is good, but wants a business behind it to become stronger, more focused, and more valuable. Richard, welcome.
Thanks very much, John. It's an honor to be on your podcast.
Oh, thank you. So, Richard, give us the short version of Mount Zero today. What does the business do? Who does it serve? And how would you describe it now?
Well, short version, that's always a little bit tricky, but essentially Mount Zero, it's an Australian fruit producer. We started out as a farm, an olive grove. And for the last 30 years, our customer base has been a mix of independent retail and great restaurants, chefs. And it continues to this day to be that mix. The only addition in the last, pretty much since COVID, has been the business-to-consumer side that we've targeted a lot. And so consumers are coming to us for their retailing, not at the same time as going to our retail network.
And so who do you see as your most important customers or customer groups?
Look, I mean, the chefs and the restaurants inform what we do. They're a benchmark for our quality. If we start to get feedback that we're not cutting it in the top restaurants in town when we're clearly doing something wrong, the retailers inform us from that we're on target in terms of price, on target in terms of our branding, and they are deliberately so the independent sector. Not so much the big two or the big three as they are now. And then finally, the end consumer could be anyone, but essentially it's a discerning home cook who loves quality ingredients, ideally has a passion for local ingredients and potentially health conscious and supporting, Australian produce.
Fantastic. And what are the main parts of the business today?
So we started out as quite a small 200-acre olive grove. We no longer have that olive grove. We've got a factory and warehouse in Sunshine West where we do all the packing of our produce. We do the fermentation of our olives. So we've got literally 150-ton capacity here on site to ferment table olives. And we've got storage for about 50,000 litres of olive oil that we're constantly bringing more in and packing down for ourselves, and we're starting to do a little bit of contract packing for others as well. And then we have our own vans and trucks doing certainly most of our Victorian deliveries and then sending off on pallets for interstate distributors.
Yeah, wow. So take us back to the beginning. How did you and your family first become involved with Mount Zero?
Yeah, I was thinking about this and in some respects, there's a common theme running through it, and you're not going to like it, John. It's almost adversity sort of driven and responding to that. So It was the early 90s. My father had been a public servant for most of his life, and he was made redundant in pretty much the only recession in my living memory. And, you know, spent 12 months renovating a house and looking around at what to do, and then fell in love with this abandoned olive grove in the Grampians. And that was actually a return to some of his childhood. He grew up on an apple orchard on the Mornington Peninsula. So it was just a return to something that, you know, was a little bit familiar with to him in terms of horticulture, but also very foreign in terms of running a business and olives. Obviously, I think I'm the only redheaded olive producer in Australia to this day. But at the time I was finishing high school, and then I had no dream of getting involved in the family business. And I went and did an applied science, and I thought I was going to become an ecotourism entrepreneur of some sort. But throughout university, I sort of helped them out, and I really found a passion and love for going in and talking to chefs and restaurateurs about what we were doing. And so I spent a little bit of time after university getting some money together, but working in wholesale food distribution, not Mount Zero, but in other companies. And there was an aha moment there where it's just like, oh, look, this is not my university training or necessarily my skill set, but geez, there's some opportunity here. And I could see where my employer at the time was doing incredibly well. I thought I could see some of the challenges or some of the problems they had, and then had the temerity to think I could do it better if I went to the family and took it on ourselves. So in 2005, I came back to the family business in a full-time sense and started running our Melbourne operation. And we actually separated the farm from the value add and the distribution side. And that's where I've been ever since.
So at what point did you think it was a farming business or food business or something else?
Look, I think we've been really conscious to keep it very primary and connected to farms and primary produce. And that's one of the sort of key values of the business. So in terms of that separation, we're trying not to break those links or very much at all. But having said that, from the outset, when I came on board, I was not on the farm, which was 300 kilometres away. I was dealing with the customer base in Melbourne. And that was very much, you know, business 101 for me, learning, you know, initially sales. And then once you've got a sale, you know, how do you deliver? Well, that's managing that person. And how do you, you know, do the second delivery? Well, you've got to manage that production facility and, you know, brick by brick from there, yeah, growing. And yes, it is very much a business now rather than a primary production.
Yeah, I can sense that there was a baptism of fire in there. Possibly when the orders got larger and you realised that your success also had to, not only did you have to have the success of selling, but also the success of delivering, logistics, supply chain, blah, blah, blah. A farming business and a food brand aren't the same thing. One's about production and the other's about capturing value in the market. What did that distinction, when did that distinction become clear to you? Because you've really doubled down on the Mount Zero.
Yeah. So
and that's a crucial part of your brand strategy, isn't it?
So we, throughout the 2000s, it was actually, they call it the millennial drought, where probably 8 of those 10 years we were in drought in the Wimmera region. And so in order to sort of see our way through, we leant on other farms or spoke to other growers. In our case, it was lentil growers. Later, it was actually the indigenous community to harvest salt from our region. And one of the defining factors that helped us from a cash flow perspective was the onset of the farmers markets. Before that, it was really hand to mouth in the business sense. And then the farmers markets came on and there was a little bit of cash flow coming back in. And for me, the aha moment was these people that just come down like they're going to church on a Saturday morning, you know, religiously come down and thank us for our produce and really supported us through. They wanted that connection with the grower or the farmer and the region so that they understood exactly what they were consuming and growing and putting in their mouths, essentially. And so that has stayed with me ever since. And having that connection, well, we're not the farmer anymore, making sure that our customers have that connection to where the produce has come from or the story that's behind it, essentially, is critical to, I think, our business plan and our success.
And so was it at that time that you first realised that the opportunity was bigger than just growing olives, or did that come later?
Yeah, well, we'd already been forced to talk to our neighbouring farms, the lentil growers, and there were a couple of years there where we had a lot more lentils than we did olives or olive oil. And so, yeah, we were becoming a, you know, a food brand in many respects. But yeah, I think the it's sort of been a slow evolution and decision to really grow in that the brand and the business beyond, you know, the farm itself. And to come back to that thread of adversity, you know, it was a recession and then a drought that forced us to make those changes. But the changes were definitely positive for us and have sort of given us that leg up and that opportunity to sort of, you know, face new challenges.
And so a lot of that was about selling product that you had access to in drought conditions. When was there a moment where you thought, we need to build the brand, not just sell the product?
It's really interesting. I actually think we'd been building the brand almost from day one. And when I say we, it was my parents particularly, you know, were really focused on getting our packaging, our branding, our logos and look, you know, really unique. And then bringing on board our customers with us. And most of that was word of mouth. And the way that the three of us all tend to work is, you know, it's through relationships. And this was pre-internet marketing. So those relationships were literally spoken, you know, around, and we grew it from Melbourne and then up the East Coast, essentially. So it wasn't until we hit COVID that I actually realized that we had a brand that really had some value to it. So we'd been building this brand the whole time and investing in it, but I didn't realize the worth until that point. And then it was an aha moment. And it's just like, we have something here. The last 20 years, really, we've filled the well in terms of our brand building. And I wasn't particularly aware of how much work we'd actually done, but looking back, absolutely. And then when we needed it, essentially through COVID, obviously we're a company who relies on restaurants for our custom and our volume, and that evaporated overnight. And so we reached out to our, you know, end consumers, and they just came back with open arms. And that was the moment that I realized actually we had a brand and we had some loyalty and people believed in what we were doing. And so then, you know, it took me 20 years, but that's when I realized that actually, right, we've got a brand here and we've got to invest in it. Because in that COVID time, I think we went back to the well and we made some withdrawals on that, if you know what I mean. But really, from here on in, the brand building is filling up the well or filling up the bank account to make occasional withdrawals, essentially.
Yeah. Absolutely. So moving from farming into manufacturing and brand building is a big transition. What had to change inside the business to help you with that?
Oh, look, I mean, I think it's effectively me. Look, we've got some great people here now. There's 35 of us, and I don't want to take anything away from what they do. They've been incredible, but I'm the bottleneck, and realizing that I was the bottleneck, you know, back in, I don't know, 2011 or 2012 to us growing, and I needed to essentially increase my know-how and expertise and in order for the rest of us to grow. And so far that's been some training, you know, being a bit of as much of a sponge as I can be around other business owners and founders, and obviously working with you, John.
So what new capabilities did you actually need to develop then? Because you've got 35 people doing a whole bunch of things. What were the stepping stones there in capability?
I think the hardest thing for me, and probably the hardest thing for anyone really, is people management. You know, we're strange beasts. You can't, you know, put us in a box and say, you know, this person does exactly that and they respond to this stimuli. No, we're all different. And learning that and having the patience for that and learning strategies there and putting in processes has been critical to, I guess, our growth. And then secondly, it's the business acumen that, you know, you think you might be intuitive at the start, and then you soon learn that, you know, right? I remember Donald Rumsfeld's comment that was everyone sort of poo-pooed, but then later on, you know, the known knowns and known unknowns and management speak that I, you know, thought was absolute rubbish. Now I've got a bit of respect for it, and there are lots of unknowns that I, you know, am beginning to know about, and I want to know more. So, and that's the critical thing for me to be able to, you know, get out from being the bottleneck and get on to being hopefully the multiplier in the business.
So that raises an important question. What did you need to stop doing?
I mean, I haven't stopped. You can't help but, you know, be in the business, learn that age-old metaphor of on it rather than in it. But you've got to sort of step back and try and find, carve out the time to, yeah, to look forward, to strategize and also improve yourself and improve the processes in the business. So what did I have to stop? You know, I can't help myself, but, you know, whether it be on the bottling line or, you know, out doing deliveries or whatever it might be, I still do it, but I just do less of it. And it's just reminding yourself that, oh, no, actually, this is not my role. And if it is, then I've done something wrong to not have that redundancy built in that someone else can do it.
Yeah, I often have conversations with my founder CEOs around, you know, is this a $50 an hour task or is this a $500 an hour task? If it's a $50 an hour task, then somebody else should be doing that for you. If it's a $500 an hour task, then maybe they are the few things that you should be focused on.
Yeah.
When you went through that transition, what did you feel you had to systemize? Because, you know, when there's only 3, 4, 10 of us, you know, systems are really important to have, but often get sort of left to one side as we're just sort of brute forcing, delivering the business of the business day to day. What did you find you had to systemize as you built the business?
Oh, look, I think it's the start of a journey when you realize that if it's all in your own head and nowhere else, then you don't have much, then, you know, you may as well be a consultant, a one-person consultant to someone else. Not to denigrate what you do, John, but unless you put the processes in place, then you've got a house of cards. And so the first thing I had to do was recognize that and remove myself from, you know, as much of the day-to-day as possible. I think my team would laugh at me if they overheard me say that right now. But anyway, but putting processes, once you start, you can't stop, you know, like, and you see the issues everywhere when you've got a star performer who has all this knowledge in their brain, but not in the system or not on the computer or nowhere else. It's like, oh my God, I've got someone who's amazing there, but I've also got a big problem coming up, you know, no matter whether it's 1 year or 5 or 10 years down the track. And so realizing that you have to get that system working and that star performer to help improve the system and be part of the system rather than, you know, be this unicorn if they are or outlier. Yeah. And so now I see it everywhere and it's just a constant challenge. So we start each week with a meeting and it has two agenda items. We talk about a product that we're, you know, either tasting or new or just to remind ourselves and we talk about a process, a new process or revisit an old process. If it's gone, you know, by the wayside or there's been too much drift, because it's the only way to sort of, I think, you know, to keep any sort of structure to the house.
Absolutely. That sounds like you've gone well past the point where Mount Zero stopped being just a farm product and started becoming a business system of suppliers, production, quality, brand, customers, and distribution all having to work together. Is that sort of right?
Good. That's the aim. Absolutely.
So Mount Zero has got a strong sense of place and provenance. How intentional was that in the early days?
Oh, very much so. So when we literally started buying produce from over the fence, we realized, okay, well, now we're becoming a bit of a food brand. Who are we and what are we and why are we doing it? And so we put some sort of key values around what that would be, and it would be very much Australian produce, and we would essentially never reach out to an imported product, not because it's not great, but that's not who we are. Yeah. And it really had to be a primary, product that we're dealing with. So something straight from the earth, essentially as unrefined as possible and as high quality as possible. So when I say quality, you know, it's a strange word, but from our perspective, the lentil growers over the fence were producing, you know, incredibly high quality lentils that were sent over to, you know, into the subcontinent in absolute tonnage as a commodity. But they were also working with a French variety that was sold in our same distribution channels as our olive oil that was imported out of France and, you know, selling for $6 or $8 a kilo at the time. And so that's the product we chose to work with. So at that premium end, that was the same market as our olive oil and our olives. And so they've sort of become the key tenets of, you know, that quality premium product, the local, and finally our farm was certified biodynamic, which is an organic method of farming. So sustainability became a key tenet of the business as well. Even though we're currently working with a lot of conventional farms and conventional produce, we're trying to make sure that we still carry and grow certified range, and we're reducing our footprint in terms of energy and plastic and other, you know, chemical use.
So on that, how did you turn quality, origin, sustainability into something that customers cared about, particularly for your chefs, independent retailers, markets, and food communities?
Yeah, I think there's the other side of that coin is our customers cared about it. So we started to care about it. And going back to when did you realize you had a brand that you built, it's that moment where your customers start to talk back to you about your value set. And so we had a moment when we first started shipping direct to consumers, and I'm like, oh, how do we do this? Oh, of course, we pack it carefully and put it in the post and send it off. So I went out and got some bubble wrap, and away we went. And then very quickly, we had an email back from a customer saying, I can't believe you're using plastic bubble wrap to send us your organic olive oil. And I'm like, oh, you know what? You're absolutely right. And I wrote back to them, and within a week, we had a cardboard shredder, and we're reusing all of our cardboard. But essentially, the customer became part of our value journey. And yeah, definitely, I've thanked that customer so many times to them themselves, but at moments like this. And I think that's the important part is that it's not just from the business down or out, it's customer-led as well. And they hold us to our values. And if we start to waver on those, you know, they'll, like lemmings, they'll jump off the cliff. And thankfully, this person let us know, and we course-corrected, and away we go.
That sounds like quite an amazing lesson about trust.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we've got to keep revisiting our value set and our purpose to make sure that we're staying consistent with those key ideals. You know, the strategy can change according to the market or whatever else, but that value and the purpose, if you veer too far away from that, the customers will let you know either by disappearing or ideally by letting you know. But yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of producers have a good product, but they don't yet have a reason for the customer to care, remember, or come back.
Mm.
Was that sort of the challenge?
I think probably through the course of the conversation, maybe I'm starting to realize some of the things that we've done that might have given us a really closer connection with our customers. And one of them was recognizing that we didn't have a commodity. You know, we had this 200-acre grove that we needed every cent of return from in order to make it work. And so therefore we needed that connection with the end consumer. And so that almost informed the rest of the journey where we've hung on to that connection as tightly as we can.
No.
Even though we now at our scale, we can, you know, ship pallets around the country and be quite removed, we choose not to be. And I think it's because of those early days where the customer was so critical and the, you know, right down to the single user or the single restaurant or single retailer. And yeah, we still keep them, you know, really strongly in mind.
Yeah, I still have fond memories of you coming into our second CEO masterclass session with a box of individual serve olives in the plastic resealable packing and said, well, you know, I'm testing out a new product idea. You guys can be the crash test dummies. What do you think?
Yeah.
That was a moment that I still remember fondly.
Never waste an opportunity.
No. So thinking about manufacturing range and quality, once you moved into table olives, olive oils, and pantry products, how did your thinking about quality change?
I mean, I think just thinking about olives and olive oil for a second, in Europe, they're producing at, you know, a scale beyond anything, you know, we can conceive. You know, in southern Spain, Andalusia, you can drive for hundreds of kilometers and not see a single other tree other than an olive tree. And so to get into this game here, you've got to be really clear about, okay, well, how do we differentiate ourselves from that? And so the quality had to be paramount because yeah, there's no way we can compete on price in some respects. But when we compare olives with olives or apples with apples, yeah, maybe we can when we really aim to be at the top of the tree. And that's where I started in saying the chefs keep us on track and inform us. And we've chosen deliberately to be an Australian brand, Australian produce, but that doesn't mean we're not informed by some great produce, you know, internationally. The Europeans produce incredible olives and olive oil, and we're constantly tasting and trying and benchmarking ourselves against them in order to improve. So how do we increase our quality? I guess, yeah, knowing that we're definitely not number one and, you know, training like we're number two or three.
Yeah. And so what has to be controlled tightly, and where can you be more flexible?
I guess we've bootstrapped it up in many respects. So we've tried to cash flow the growth of our business from the start and to this day. And so the other strange thing that would be probably anathema to a lot of other business plans is that we have been vertically integrated from the start. You know, we're doing our own deliveries, we're running our own packing lines, our own warehouse. There's no such thing as 3PL with what we do. And so that's a really expensive and resource heavy thing to do. And, you know, maybe if you and I were, you know, strategizing 20 years ago, you may well have suggested otherwise, and you're probably right. But having done it, we've bought, you know, secondhand lines and had that sort of semi-manual, semi-automatic sort of system to what we do. And it's allowed us to sort of go on that, you know, our growth has matched the trajectory of, I guess, our growth in the marketplace has been matched by the growth in our production ability and facility, and similarly in our human resources side of things. We haven't taken the, you know, some amazing hockey stick trajectory, but we haven't taken a back step at the same time. So this constant improvement, and now for the first time in a long time, we're investing in brand new equipment, which is, you know, a whole nother journey. But I think the whole team appreciates it, you know, when we get it in. And at the same time, we know, you know, the price the people are willing to pay for this, you know, 10 years ago hasn't changed necessarily. But we've upped our skill set and our output and our productivity, and we've passed a lot of that on to the consumer, but we haven't let our margins, you know, narrow too much whilst we've driven this productivity sort of gains.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely essential. And the simple reality is, Richard, that, you know, when I look around the businesses that are heading on their way to 50 million in their early years, virtually all of them were buying equipment and capability on the secondhand market and doing that as carefully as they could. And, you know, when you're dealing with stainless steel, and there's lots of it around so many of my clients, including yours, the good thing about it is it doesn't deteriorate too much. So, you know, there's a lot of high quality stainless steel stuff out there that'll be functional in 40 years' time.
Absolutely.
So how do you decide whether a new product belongs under the Mount Zero brand?
It's a really tough one because I love creating and coming up with new ideas and bits and pieces. So for instance,
that's the challenge of just about every CEO founder that I've come across. They've got more ideas than they can execute in a lifetime. So
yeah. And so the aim is to put as much as we can under the Mount Zero brand, and that's 90% of it. We've got some basket fillers that we sell online of other brands and businesses, but that's purely with kind of a hangover from COVID where we reached out to customers that were taking our oil or using our salt in their product, and it sits on our website. But essentially everything we do, carries the brand. And how do we select that? We'll try and limit it. We've got way too many products, and I know that. But essentially the best test kitchens are the restaurants that we supply. And if it holds up there, we know it's something we can potentially roll out into the retail environment. And we'll often test that now in the last 6 or so years that we've got a really good e-commerce platform going. We'll test that online. And if we get some good results there, then we'll try and roll it out through the retail network. But as important as MPD is, it's the other side of the culling, you know, the duds. And thankfully, I've got a production manager who puts up a slide every week of the flobs, the slow-moving, obsolete.
Obsolete, yeah.
And essentially, he does it in order to sort of give the sales team a bit of a what for. But at the same time, you know, that helps inform what's got to come off over time as well, or be refined.
Yeah, no, it's an essential thing. Otherwise, you end up with a basket just brimming with stuff that down the bottom, most of it's not selling.
Yes.
So thinking about partnerships, Mount Zero now works with growers and product partners way beyond the original farm. How did that change the business model?
Yeah, look, I think expanding the horizons and talking to others and other businesses and farmers is really almost a coming of age moment where suddenly you're not in the family fold and you're getting feedback and you're being, for the most part, you know, in a really positive way, you're pulling together for a common goal, you know, whether it be a supplier, customer supplier relationship or a true collab. And there's some great crossover intellectually as well, because, you know, as a small business owner, you know, you've got yourself and your team and your family to bounce things off. And then suddenly when you start talking with growers and suppliers and collaborators, there's a multiplier effect possible there as well. And that's been certainly the last, you know, 5 to 10 years been a really important factor for us. And we've actually started a collab with our main olive grower in our fermentation side. And what we've been able to achieve there is sort of that realization I couldn't have done that alone. And I wouldn't have thought to do it that way. And it's like, oh, wow. And in hindsight, yeah, of course. And hopefully it's been, you know, mutually rewarding the other way as well. But yeah, so it's interesting. It's also, you know, you've got to go with your eyes open and make sure that, you know, you're getting, it's working for everybody essentially. And you've got to be quite, you know, assertive about what you want and need. Yeah.
Yeah, but, it needs to work in both directions, but you also need to establish good boundaries, I guess.
Yeah.
What makes, from your perspective, what makes a good grower or supply partner?
I think empathy with what we're trying to achieve. And I have empathy with the grower. And I think coming back to, you know, that farmer's market, the customers that came to us with empathy for what we were doing and, you know, whether it be drought or the primary produce or cash flow issues or whatever, they understood it. And I am really invested in our business and our brand and supported us through it. And I think the same goes with growers and Mount Zero as a customer. The more we understand each other, the more we can support each other to, I think, really grow in the right direction. And I think, so yeah, empathy and great communication.
Yes. Yeah. And being cognizant of each other's, of helping each other benefit from the partnership.
Yeah.
I think it's also an essential part, because if it's all about the only thing is what's in it for me, as opposed to what's in it for we,
yeah,
then really you're just a contractor with a K, and that's not necessarily a mutually beneficial, as you mentioned before, arrangement. Question around climate. Has climate or seasonality changed much about the way you think about risk?
Absolutely. There are two things there. So horticulture in Australia is absolutely linked to rainfall and water availability, and will drive the, you know, essentially the supply and therefore the price of our produce, whether it be olives, olive oil, or, you know, anything else we sell. But they're the two main ones. And internationally, we saw that in the 2023-24 seasons, where Spain had two of the worst seasons they've ever had. They were about 30% down for 2 years running. And little old Mount Zero, who thought we weren't a commodity and would never be affected by commodity prices, suddenly prices were peaking everywhere. Our product was selling incredibly well. And I thought, oh, woohoo, this is fantastic. But the problem is, or has shown, that these sort of peaks and troughs in the market are really problematic. Because so what happened with us, where we supply restaurants, is a good 50% of our business. And so a lot of those restaurants bought as much olive oil as they could through that period, but at the same time they were substituting, you know, canola oil and seed oils where they could as well.
Jeez.
And that hasn't come back, you know, so the prices may have settled and come down, but there's a habit that's changed there. Yeah. And the consumption. And it probably happened in the retail sense as well. People jumped off the bus, the olive oil bus. So while the industry might have been patting itself on the back here, saying, oh, isn't this wonderful? And it was for a little while there. I think it affected the whole pie that we share. And so getting back to climate and climate change, yeah, I think it's a huge challenge for us to navigate. You know, it's not a challenge to overcome. It's just a challenge to navigate. And it'd be really interesting in the next few years.
Yeah. Well, particularly if we look at the long range forecast for the next 5 years, which look quite tumultuous. I guess that sounds like a classic scaling issue that many founders and CEOs need to address. And that is that as the business grows, the founder really has to protect the things that make the business valuable in the first place. So thinking about the hard commercial realities, a lot of founders love the product, but the business has to make money. What did you have to learn about margins, channels, and scale?
It was actually almost the good times that got me reflecting on it more than the hard times. For so long, it was, you know, pushing the team and that just wringing that oily rag, you know. And then when we had a couple of years where it was slightly better, it's just like, oh, you know, the stress. And it's like, we're only talking, you know, a slight amount. The stress levels were down. I think the team were, you know, probably not responding so much to my cortisol. And it's like, well, actually, it's because of our business fundamentals are that little bit better. It gives you that breathing space to essentially want more and look at margin, look at stock turn, look at, you know, some of the key indicators in the business.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until, probably should have been a lot earlier, but it wasn't until actually, you know, we'd had a year or two of, you know, semi-decent years, and it's just like, oh, that's the difference. And I never want to go back there again. And I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that we don't, because the decisions you make when you're, you know, really wringing that rag out are not always the best ones.
That can be very short-term focused.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the big numbers for you that are most important, product margins, customer margins, DIFOT, your inventory turns, your debtor days, are they the key ones that you keep an eye on?
Yeah, absolutely.
And your SLOBEX?
The margin is key, and it sort of becomes a bit of a, you know, if we can't get that margin out of it, then it's not worth necessarily doing. So it becomes, you know, a fairly binary call. You know, we can't do that. There's not margin in it for us.
It either works or it doesn't.
Yeah, exactly. And then the debtor days is a critical one as well, particularly because we're growing. Cash flow is a constant challenge, and keeping an eye on those. And if, you know, if we have a, you know, thankfully we've got a great team here, but if we have a bookkeeper that's away for a couple of weeks, or, you know, someone who's not as good as the last one, or it might be 3 months later that you go, oh, what's happened to our cash flow? And you actually realize it started 3 months ago, and there's a real hill to climb to get out of it. So yeah, that's one that we look pretty closely at.
Well, absolutely. And particularly if you've got a product that might be fermenting for more than 12 months that you're paying for in advance, it's a long cash flow burn between when it comes through the door to the time that it goes back out the door.
Absolutely.
You know, you're building up quite a bank there. Mm. Which channels have been the hardest to make work from that perspective, from a cash flow perspective?
In terms of distribution and sales channels?
Yeah.
The obvious one that has transformed our business from a cash flow perspective in a positive way is the direct-to-consumer side. So, yeah, that's the positive. The challenging one, I mean, I think, like, restaurants, I don't want to talk them down because they're the bread and butter of what we do, but my God, that's a tough space to be in. I think per capita, we've got more restaurants than almost anywhere else in the world. And so it's a very competitive space, and it's no surprise that any time the economy either stagnates or, you know, gets a cold, that we have restaurants struggling to pay their bills. So that's a constant challenge, and something we've, you know, got to keep on top of, and have learned to be a little bit more hard-nosed about. The retailers, you know, similarly, we choose to deal with the ones that are not, you know, the Coles or Woolworths. It's the others. And that's a tough space as well, because if you're not in those two majors, yeah, it's a challenging environment to be in, because you're being, you know, some really heavy competition. But on the whole, that we've got some great customers, you know, both in the retail and the food service side. But yeah, the revelation was essentially the direct-to-consumer, the cash flow impact that has is incredible.
Yeah. Okay, so let's think about leadership, mistakes and focus. As the business has grown, what's changed in your role as founder and CEO?
I just think primarily I've got to, with each step of growth, I've got to raise my eye level, you know, another year in advance or, you know, month, year, 2-3 years in advance to make sure that we have, you know, the MPD coming through. You know, the MPD is not my, you know, thankfully I've got some people working on that, but making sure that essentially that's filtering through or that we're investing in the right machinery, that we've got the partnerships in the farms and our supply chain and that we're, yeah, so essentially, yeah, learning to look up and beyond and set that strategy becomes far more important than it was, you know, 10 years ago.
Yeah, that strategic outlook, looking over the horizon as opposed to the day-to-day. So thinking about your leadership, what were you good at naturally and what did you have to learn perhaps the hard way?
I think I'm fairly resourceful and pragmatic, so I can get myself out of a hole pretty well, but fundamentally I don't want to be in the hole. And that's what I had to learn is, so the business acumen, you know, has come through mistakes and more recently has come through as much investment in time and training that I can get through, as I mentioned, through you, John, and through others. Any opportunity that comes up, I'll put my hand up for short course or training or anything. So, whereas, yeah, and then the rest of it is not wanting to fall back in that hole, you know, and so it's been learning some of the key metrics, you know, of debtor days, margin, net margin, and, you know, looking at what our overheads are and reporting on that and talking to the team about it as well and bringing the team on board, because it's all very well knowing myself or having an idea myself, but unless people actually see it, and then that builds some ownership and empathy within the business that, oh, hey, this isn't right, or this is right, we've got to chase that, and bringing everyone else in the business along on that journey, whether it be a positive one or the awareness of the negative side as well.
It's really interesting, Richard, because so many CEOs and founders in their early years, you know, I see it a lot in the under 10 million turnover range, they're fearful of sharing their numbers fully with their staff because, you know, when things are tough, they think, oh, they're going to worry and they might leave, or they're going to worry for their jobs, or they're going to worry about worrying. But what that does is puts all the pressure on the founder or the CEO, and it doesn't actually empower the team to help work their way through it. Have you experienced that in your own environment?
Yeah, absolutely.
Is that part of your learning?
Absolutely. So probably going back 6 or 8 years now, we share those metrics. Literally, it's actually one of the best things we do in the business. We're a food business. And the first Monday of the month, one of the team will cook for everybody. And there are those that don't want to do it, and that's fine. But most of us are passionate cooks. And so we'll cook for the team. And following that, we'll share some KPIs in the business. And so we'll share our turnover, we'll share our gross profit, and we'll share the labor cost in relation to that as a percentage. And based on those metrics, and we share our values, and we champion someone who might have someone who might have really lived those values in that month. And then based on that, we'll pay, you know, a fairly small but a not insignificant sort of bonus to, you know, everyone. And it's a flat, you know, whether you're a senior or sweeping the floor, it's a flat sort of amount. Yeah. And it's just based on, yeah, we met this, we did really well this month, or we didn't meet it, and here's why. And some of those things people can't necessarily impact, you know, the people in production can't impact immediately the sales, you know, pull through. But when we do meet those common goals, then we can celebrate it together. And I think sharing that also, you know, means people stay for the course and you know, through the good and the bad.
Definitely. So what do you now understand about leadership that you didn't understand 15 years ago?
I think it's as much about listening and questioning, or it's probably more about that than it is directing, you know? So I was, and probably still am, you know, the type that would, you're trying to lead by example, and in some respects just, you know, roll up my sleeves and push someone out of the way. And that's not going to, you know, that's going to be pretty limiting. And so learning to stand back and listen and question, and it's a journey because I'm not necessarily natively good at that.
None of us are perfect.
But yeah, it's better than yeah, pushing people out of the way or being directive.
Yeah, certainly one of the sayings that I share with, possibly to their annoyance when it gets repeated, is she who asks the best questions leads. And, you know, if you can ask a really helpful question, a really open question that helps somebody actually unpack the challenge themselves so that they can come up with their own answer and problem solve themselves, they're far more likely to learn from the experience and then also implement the outcome as part of that process. So it's not about manipulation, it's about practical learning experience for, oh, why do you think that, you know, why do you think that our inventory turns have dropped back from 12 times a year to 6 times a year? What do you think about, what do you think the factors are? You know, when they're having that thought about the process, it really transforms the way they think for themselves, and you're actually empowering them to be a problem solver as opposed to you having to push them out of the way and show them how to do it again.
Yeah.
So this is one of those important founder lessons where the question is not, is this a good idea, but is this the right idea for this business at this time? So where's Mount Zero heading from here?
So Mount Zero has had this micro focus on the local, you know, our local customers here in Victoria and Melbourne in particular, our suppliers, all within about a 300-kilometre radius. The supply side probably won't change. Olive growing in Victoria is, I think, in terms of Australia, definitely the best place to be. But customer side, we've got some opportunities to make Sydney and Brisbane and, you know, Adelaide and Perth similar marketplaces for us. And that won't necessarily be an easy road because, you know, Sydney, obviously the number one market, obviously the probably definitely the number most competitive market at the same time.
Mm.
But I think if we stay true to the values and the products and the customer service that we've put around our range here, we can take on those markets and they'll see the value that we create. And I think in terms of the produce, the side, the table olives is what we're investing quite heavily in. One, because it's a great opportunity, but it's also really hard to do. And so we've been at it for quite a while. We know how hard it is. There's a big cash flow challenge, as I think you mentioned earlier. You know, when you put an olive into brine, it's a 9-month journey before you can essentially take it out and put it in something and sell it. So to get to any sort of scale is really challenging for anyone, big or small. So I feel like we've got a pretty good head start. We've been at it for a lot longer than most of our local competitors. And so, yeah, I see that as being, you know, the product that'll take us into, you know, the Sydney and Brisbane and will differentiate us going forward. And then the investment that we put behind that, whether it be in branding and product development, but effectively doubling down on the fact that we're an olive business more than we maybe once were an olive, salt, lentil and regional Wimmera business.
Yeah, no, I can see where you're going then. And what do you see as being the biggest constraints on that?
I think most of it is internal. I think it's the ability to lead and curate a great team. I think the market is going to be there. Obviously, we want the market to be booming, but even in quiet times, the market is there. It's just, it's on us to have a great team that's being productive, creative, and assertive in the sales space. And yeah, that's what I'm focused on.
Good. And so if we were sitting here with a glass of bubbles, with bubbles in it, in our hands, celebrating what Mount Zero had become in 2036, what do you want the business to be known for in 10 years' time? What are we going to be celebrating?
Oh, wow. Question without notice, John. Oh, look, I think it's that olive, the olive side of things. I mean, First and foremost, I think we should be celebrating that we've stayed true to our values and our tenets. So we're still a locally produced product. We're still essentially focused on local markets and supporting and selling to those that, you know, helped us grow through along that way. And that's that, you know, particularly the restaurant and chef industry.
Exceptional quality.
Exceptional quality. And yeah, we've ideally become, you know, the number one player by a long shot when it comes to table olives. You know, the olive oil will definitely be there and be a really big part of what we do. But the table olives is the huge opportunity for us. And if I think there's an opportunity to corner the market or take a big slice of the Australian pie.
Mm. Fantastic. Cool. Okay. So coming up to a critical few actions. So thinking about those all important critical few actions now, looking back, what were the two or three actions that made the biggest difference for Mount Zero and for yourself as a leader and a founder?
I think having really clearly defined values and tenets in the business allows you to have a conversation. So originally with my parents about, you know, product development or markets or potential growers and partners. And if you go back to those values, and it's really easy to pretty much make a binary decision. Yes, it's a fit. No, it's not. And if it's not, you know, move on, you know, because not all that glitters is gold as well. You know, like it's something, this golden, you know, whatever it might be. But if it comes down, it's not a fit with your values, then don't go there, because that really is going to erode your brand. Then your customers see it straight away. And then I think some of that business acumen of knowing some of the data points to pull out, margin is essentially critical, and then the way that essentially flows into everything else, but ultimately cash flow and profit from that. Yeah, and then finally, strategy, being able to look beyond the horizon and set a plan and a course for, you know, whether it be growth or improvement or, you know, product development and around that.
Yeah, fantastic. So now to put the hard edge on it, if we were to make that practical for another founder or CEO, what one or two things should they do starting next week?
Yeah, I think the purpose, you know, defining what you're there for, what you and your team or your partner or whoever it is are setting out to do, and then what are the things you're going to love doing and celebrating and sharing with your customer base, and what are the absolute no's that you're not going to do, and effectively they're your value set, you know, and your boundaries, and those two things for me, yeah, shouldn't change, you know, from day one to day whenever. The strategy comes next, I think, and that can definitely change, but you'll always go back to that, the purpose and the values to test your strategy.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, yeah, those three things.
What I'm taking away from the Mount Zero story is not just about olives and olive oil. It's about moving from production to value creation, understanding the customer, protecting quality, building trust, choosing partners carefully, and making sure that the business captures the value from what it creates and is true to the tenets that it starts out with. That's a powerful lesson for any founder who's had a great product but needs to build a stronger business around it. Richard, thank you. It's been an absolute delight.
Thanks, John. And I also thank you for the guidance along the way, because some of that strategic work and business acumen came from you and others, and wouldn't be the same without it.
Thank you, Richard. That's very generous. I appreciate it.
As you can tell, Richard Seymour's Mount Zero Olives story is a useful reminder that a good product is only the starting point. The stronger business is built around it. What stood out for me was the way that Mount Zero turned provenance, quality and values into practical business decisions. Values weren't just words on a page. They helped decide what products belonged, which partners fitted, what had to be protected, and what needed to be refused. The other learning is commercial. Brand trust matters. But so does margin, cash flow, debtor days, stock turns, and the systems that stop everything living in the founder's head. So if you're listening to this and wondering whether your business is capturing enough value it creates, Download the OPV scorecard in the show notes. It'll help you identify the few priorities that deserve your attention now. And if this issue is live in your business, get in touch. This is exactly where the right critical few actions can make a real difference.